Welcome to another edition of American History for the Modern Patriot. This is Dr. Susan Rempel. Please help support this podcast by downloading a Kindle copy of my book, Everyone's Guide to the Constitution, for just $3.76 on Amazon. It's a great primer to begin studying the Constitution and suitable for all ages. A paperback version of the text is also available on Amazon. What extraordinary steps were taken by the Continental Army to limit British navigation of the Hudson River? What is a chevaux de frise, a boom, and a fire raft? Is it truly possible that a chain could have been stretched across the mighty Hudson? We will learn the answers to these questions in this episode. In the 14th edition of American History for the Modern Patriot, we learned about the separation of powers, which is a barrier created for us by our founders to assure our liberty. In this episode, we will learn about a series of great barriers created across one of the most important waterways during the American Revolution. Strategists for the Continental Army, with drastically limited resources in comparison to their opponent, looked for clever ways to achieve success. It was far easier for both men and supplies to travel along rivers than on foot. They knew that the British would be crippled if their war and supply ships could not freely travel along the Hudson River. Not only did the ships carry supplies, but they carried soldiers, munitions, and communications as well. Of the river, George Washington said in a letter to General Israel Putnam on December 2, 1777, quote, "The importance of the Hudson River in the present contest and the necessity of defending it are subjects which have been so frequently and fully discussed and are so well understood that it is unnecessary to enlarge upon them." To understand how important the river was to the British, consider that in August of 1776, General William Howe and his brother Admiral Richard Howe had established a base of command at Staten Island that included approximately 34,000 troops and 427 ships. Outmanned, outgunned, and outfinanced, the colonists had to use strategies to their advantage whenever they could. Although it took some time to construct the first obstruction on the Hudson, on May 25, 1775, which is only weeks after the Battle of Lexington, the following resolve was passed by the Continental Congress. Quote, "Resolved that a post be also taken in the highlands on each side of Hudson's River, and batteries erected in such manner as will most effectively prevent any vessels passing that may be sent to harass the inhabitants on the borders of said river, and that experienced persons be immediately sent to examine said river in order to discover where it will be most advisable and proper to obstruct the navigation." Before learning more about their attempts to block the river, let's spend a moment learning about the installations that were built along the Hudson. They will be an important part of this story. First is Fort Lee. Fort Lee is located near the Hackensack Township in New Jersey. It was located across the river from Fort Washington. The fort was built just above Burdett's Landing on what is known as the Hudson Palisades. Located directly across the river from Fort Lee is another installation known as Fort Washington. Fort Washington sits on the highest northern point of the island of Manhattan. The fort sits on an outcrop of rock known as Manhattan Schist. Now let's learn about another pair of forts. Fort Montgomery is located near Peekskill, New York. It was built where the Poplopin Creek empties into the Hudson near Bear Mountain. It is near a site known as Anthony's Nose, which is named for a formation known as St. Anthony's Face on Breakneck Ridge. Talk about painting a picture with words. Across from Fort Montgomery is Fort Clinton. Fort Clinton sat on the south side of the Poplopin Gorge. It was a slightly smaller fortification than Fort Montgomery, but it was better defended and on a higher point of ground. Last but not least is Fort Constitution. This is near the site of what we think of as West Point. It was the first site advocated for fortification by New Yorkers James Clinton and Christopher Tappan, and would have rested on a 160-acre island in the middle of the river, which is known as Martelier's Rock. However, much disagreement arose over the intricate and extensive plans developed by Dutch-born surveyor Bernard Romans, not to mention the considerable expense of building such an extensive fortification on such a difficult piece of property. Romans was unwilling to modify his plan, saying, quote, "A less and more imperfect plan would only be beginning a stronghold for an enemy." Consequently, building stopped, and Fort Montgomery became the focus of construction. Let's learn about the first barrier. It was a chevaux de frise, stretching between Fort Lee and Fort Washington. Strategically located on the island of Manhattan, George Washington put troops from Pennsylvania to work building what would become Fort Washington during the summer of 1776. Before construction of the fort itself began, one of the first projects for the troops was to construct a chevaux de frise. What is a chevaux de frise? Think of it, or rather them, as a series of submerged boxes. In the box would be placed logs with iron points on top. They were invisible from the surface and intended to make navigation through the waters a treacherous business. It seems that such a barrier was first proposed to the Pennsylvania Committee of Safety by a Mr. Robert Smith in July of 1775. In a meeting chaired by Benjamin Franklin, it was noted, quote, "Mr. Robert Smith, carpenter, appeared at this board with a model of a machine for obstructing the navigation of the River Delaware and explained the construction of it, which was approved of." Although Mr. Smith's suggestion was for a chevaux de frise to be placed elsewhere, it quickly became a popular method of obstruction in rivers and harbors throughout the colonies. I have to report that I found conflicting evidence of exactly what was sunk in the Hudson for this effort. Several authors said that colonists used 60-foot logs, which would have been no small feat considering there were no cranes or other construction equipment to hoist those logs about. Each log was secured in a caisson at the bottom of the river. Another author said that the obstruction was not limited to logs. The soldiers reportedly spent more than a month moving large boulders from the highest point of Manhattan Island down to the river's side. However, in a letter from General Israel Putnam to General Gates on July 26, 1776, he reported specific plans for this chevaux de frise. Let me read it to you. Quote, "We are preparing chevaux de frise at which we make great dispatch by the help of ships which are to be sunk, a scheme of mine which you may be assured is very simple, a plan of which I send you. The two ships' sterns lie towards each other, about 70 feet apart. Three large logs, which reach from ship to ship, are fastened to them. The two ships and logs stop the river 280 feet. The ships are to be sunk, and when hauled down on one side, the picks will be raised up to a proper height, and they must inevitably stop the river, if the enemy will let us sink them." The officer in charge of the construction, a Captain Cook, reported to the New York Convention in September of 1776 of his apprehension that the general's plan might need a bit of tinkering. He suggested that 5 or 6 ships should be sunk to the north of the original obstruction in order to increase its effectiveness. That, of course, did not sit well with the convention for financial reasons. It was noted on October 3rd that Captain Cook was, quote, "now up the river cutting timber for the chevaux de frise." As he is much wanted here to sink the old vessels, the general begs that you would immediately send him down. We are at a stand for want of him, for he has superintended the matter from the beginning. He knows best the properest places to be obstructed." Unfortunately, Captain Cook's placements did not work as well as he expected. On October 9th, Tench Tillman reported to the convention, quote, "About 8 o'clock this morning, the Roebuck and Phoenix and a frigate of 20 guns got underway from about Bloomingdale, where they have been laying for some time, and steered on with an easy southerly breeze toward our chevaux de frise, which we hope would have given them some interruption, while our batteries played upon them. But to our surprise and mortification, they all ran through without the least difficulty and without receiving the least apparent damage." 1 week later, the British took control of Fort Washington. There was no way to repair the obstructions, and I'm guessing there was little interest in it given the complete failure of General Putnam's simple idea. Let's move on to the second barrier. It was a chain that stretched between Forts Montgomery and Clinton. When I learned about one of the barriers that we will study in this episode, I was truly amazed. Imagine a time when funding was extremely limited, materials scarce, and artisans willing to do certain work was in real short supply. And yet, not one, but two chains were built and placed across the Hudson River. One of them was even known as the Great Chain. We aren't talking about a thin chain, mind you, but a massive one that stretched across the mighty Hudson. A map of the area surrounding Forts Clinton and Montgomery, drawn in 1777, noted that the chain may have stretched as long as 400 yards. Although each side was anchored securely to land, the chain also required floats, which positioned them near the surface. Additionally, each of the floats were anchored to the river's bottom. Each of the anchors were adjusted to withstand the current at that particular spot in the river. But that was not the only thing that stretched across the river. A boom, or a protective series of logs, were stretched across the river to fortify the chain. Chains were fastened between the logs to bind them together into one long obstruction across the river. Those chains were also fastened to anchors. Chains were used in rivers other than the Hudson during both the French Indian War as well as the American Revolution. As early as May 3, 1776, there was correspondence referencing a chain. George Washington wrote to General Philip Schuyler that, quote, "You will also receive the chain which General Lee ordered and which I think should be sent to and fixed at the place it is designed for, with all possible expedition. It may be of great service and benefit." 2 days later, he wrote to John Hancock, the president of the Continental Congress, that he had ordered Schuyler to, quote, "have the boon fixed as soon as possible." Unlike the specificity of the letter from General Putnam that we heard earlier, there are few letters discussing the specifics of the earliest chains, lest the British learn of their existence due to the cost and difficulties in constructing them. The one referenced by Washington was installed in the Sorel River near Montreal. That chain was considered so valuable that it was taken in a retreat from a battle in late May. Soon after the resolution of the Continental Congress we heard earlier, New Yorkers Major Christopher Tappan and Colonel James Clinton recommended to the Congress on June 13, 1775, the construction of what would become Forts Montgomery and Clinton begin as soon as possible. Included in their recommendation was the following statement, quote, "Your committee beg leave to observe that they are informed that by means of four or five booms chained together on one side of the river, ready to be drawn across the passage, can be closed up to prevent any vessel passing or repassing. So what, might you ask, is a boom? It's a type of obstacle or obstruction that's strung across the river or another body of water and is generally something that floats. Noting that the simple chevaux de frise had not even given pause to the British ship, they moved on to a chain and boom configuration, which stretched from Fort Montgomery to Anthony's Nose. To further this project, a secret committee was formed on July 16, 1776, from members of the Convention of the Representatives of the State of New York to, quote, devise and carry into execution such measures as to them shall appear most effectual for obstructing the channel of Hudson's River or annoying the enemy's ships in the passage up said river, and that this convention pledge themselves for defraying the charges incident thereto. The committee included a Mr. Pauling, Robert Livingston, Major Tappan, Robert Yates, and John Jay. The committee initially asked for 150 14-foot-long pine logs that would be secured to use as flotation devices for the chain. On July 25th, Samuel Tudor, Augustus Lawrence, and Jacobus Van Zandt were appointed to oversee the project if committee members were not available. They instructed those men that, quote, if it should be found impractical at or near said fort, then to fix the same at or near Fort Constitution. General Schuyler was instructed to secure the chain that had been saved from the Sorrel River, and additional links from Colonel Robert Livingston's ironworks in Ancram, New York, were ordered in case that chain was not of sufficient length. The chain, you see, would be 1,800 feet in length. At one point, it was believed that they would not have access to the already made chain. The committee, therefore, made detailed plans for a new one. On August 1, 1776, the committee, quote, resolved, therefore, that Mr. Jacobus Van Zandt, Mr. Lawrence, and Mr. Tudor be directed to form the rafts agreeable to the following plan, that each raft be formed of 5 logs of not less than 50 feet in length, placed 10 feet apart and framed together by 3 cross pieces, that each raft be placed 15 feet apart and connected by strong chain of 1.5 inch thick and anchored with their butts down the river, that the butts be shod with iron, that each member of this committee be directed to inquire for and purchase as many anchors and cables as they can procure, and send word to this committee by the 7th day of this month of the number they can obtain. Luckily, Robert Yates was able to report to George Washington on August 13th that, quote, the chain intended for the Sorrel is arrived and will form a quarter part of the one designed for Hudson's River. The iron for the remainder is come to hand, and the smiths began this day to forge it. We have agreed to fix one end of it at Fort Montgomery, and the other at the foot of the mountain called Anthony's Nose. It will cross the river obliquely, and for that reason be less exposed to the force of the tide, and less liable to injury from the ships of the enemy. The length of that chain will at least be 2,100 feet. Debate continued between that time and mid-October as to whether the chain should be placed at Fort Montgomery or Fort Constitution. Although Jacobus Van Zandt favored the site at Fort Constitution, there was harsh criticism of plans drawn by Bernard Romans for the site. Consequently, work there was delayed. Because of that reason, as well as the chain's length would be shorter if situated at Fort Montgomery, the committee voted, quote, that Mr. Matchin immediately prepare a place on side of the river at Fort Montgomery to fasten the ends of the intended chain to, that he place 2 or 3 funds in a small breastwork to be erected for that purpose on a flat place just under the north end of the Grand Battery, where the fire rafts now lay. Also a small work, if time permit, near the water edge on the south side of Poplopin's Kill. By mid-November, the chain had been assembled, fixed to the logs, and positioned in the river. Unfortunately, correspondents from the New York Convention to the Continental Congress on November 28th reported, quote, "The great length of the chain, being upward of 1,800 feet, the bulk of the logs which were necessary to support it, the immense weight of water which it accumulated, and the rapidity of the tide have baffled our efforts. It separated twice after holding only a few hours, and we have too much reason to despair of it ever fully answering the important purpose for which it was constructed." Here is where we will meet an important figure in this story. Captain Thomas Matchen. Matchen, an engineer, was authorized on November 30th to take charge of the project. He was placed in charge of the chain and found that a faulty length in the chain broke because of the swift river tides. It was repaired, and the chain was again placed in the river. Unfortunately, on October 6, 1777, the British captured both Fort Clinton and Montgomery. Within 3 hours, General Sir Henry Clinton, of no relation to the fort, and his troops took possession of both structures. They dismantled the chain and proceeded to use it as a trophy. It is estimated that the chain, which was strung from St. Anthony's Nose to Fort Montgomery, cost the colonial forces £70,000 in the currency of the day. Although it is not an obstacle, let's learn about a truly spectacular offensive maneuver to be sure, the fire raft on the Hudson. Another tactic, which evidently has been in use since the time of the Philistines, is the fire ship or fire raft. Unlike the chevaux de frise, you can easily visualize what goes on with these weapons. Instead of the phrase lock and load, think of it as load and light. On July 16, 1776, Mr. Van Zandt wrote to New York's Governor Clinton, quote, "As you were pleased forward us General Washington's orders to complete a number of fire rafts and fire vessels, we have the pleasure to inform you that 4 fire rafts will be launched this evening. Tomorrow we propose to fix them in the best manner we can with dry wood, tar, and such other combustibles as we can procure at this place. 2 or 3 old vessels which we shall fix as fast as possible for the same purpose. We shall send the fire rafts down to Colonel Clinton as soon as completed." What, you might ask, was included in those combustibles? Correspondence from the secret committee we discussed above on July 27th included the following list. Quote, "Light wood and pine knots for fire vessels, to be got at Esopus and Albany. Mr. Tappan, to procure 3 old sloops and send them down to Poughkeepsie, loaded with those knots and light wood, and as much pitch, tar, turpentine, and tar tubs and barrels as can be got. Mr. Livingston and Mr. Yates to procure the same number of sloops and to send them down loaded with the same materials. The pitch, tar, and turpentine not to exceed 100 barrels. Also oakum and junks of rope. Also to procure 100 ash oars from 14 to 20 feet long. Mr. G. Livingston to procure 6 longboats and send them to Poughkeepsie. To get 12 fire grappling irons made. To get 1,000 fire arrows made. To fill up 1 or 2 armed sloops at Albany. To send to Salisbury for all the cannon and all the shot that can be procured there." This party seems to have been a one-time event on the Hudson, but nonetheless, a sight to be sure. Listen to the account, as printed in the 1826 Worcester Magazine, of Mr. Joseph Bass, who, under the command of Commodore Tupper, was in charge of a fireship on the evening of August 16, 1776. Quote, "The Commodore selected Bass to take charge of one and put the other under the command of Captain Thomas, who belonged to New London. The vessel commanded by Bass was a sloop called the Polly, of about 100 tons burthen, nearly new. That commanded by Thomas was of a smaller size. The frigates lay about 8 miles above Kingsbridge, but having had information that they might be attacked, removed their station towards western shore of the river, where the water was deeper than on the east side. The fireships had been prepared with faggots of the most combustible kinds of wood, which had been dipped in melted pitch, and with bundles of straw cut about a foot long, prepared in the same manner. These faggots and bundles filled the deck and hold as far aft as the cabin, and into this mass of combustible materials was inserted a match that might be fired by a person in the cabin, who would have time to escape through a door cut in the side of the vessel into a whaleboat that was lashed to the quarter of the sloop. Besides these combustibles, there were in each vessel 10 or 12 barrels of pitch. A quantity of canvas amounting to many yards was cut into strips about a foot in width, and then dipped into spirits of turpentine and hung upon the spars and rigging, extending down to the deck. Everything had been so prepared that but a moment's time was required to set the whole vessel in a blaze. The fireships started from the Sputin Dewel Creek about dark, with a south wind and a favorable tide. The night was cloudy and dark, with occasionally a little rain. Bass had 9 men attached to his vessel, 3 of whom he stationed in the whaleboat. 4 had charge of the grappling irons, and 1 acted as pilot, while Bass stationed himself in the cabin to light the materials. Besides the 2 British frigates, there was a bomb ketch and 2 tenders, which were moored near them. They were anchored in a line about north and south, first the Phoenix of about 44 guns, next the Rose of 36 guns, then the bomb catch, and above it the tenders. As the night was dark and the fireships kept near the middle of the river, they were not aware that they were near the British vessels until they heard immediately to their left the striking of the bells and the cry of the sentinels, "All's well!" It was 12 o'clock, and little did those who were slumbering there imagine the destruction that hung over them. The shore was bold and rose above the masts, and in its dark shadow the Americans could not distinguish the situation of the vessels, neither could they ascertain their size, or which of them were frigates. Bass was a considerable distance in advance of Thomas, and upon hearing the cry of the sentinels, he immediately bore down on the line of the British fleet. He was already very near the bomb catch before he was discovered by the enemy, and soon struck her. The grappling irons were made fast in an instant. The whaleboat was ready to cast off. The match was applied, and both vessels were almost immediately in a blaze. Bass and his crew made their way to the shore, where the panic-struck crew of the catch was seen pouring from their quarters in the utmost consternation. Several of them perished in the flames. Others jumped into the water and were rescued by vessels of the fleet, and the catch soon burned up so as to part with her moorings, when she drifted on shore and was consumed to water's edge. Captain Thomas was not so fortunate. He was far in the rear, and the light from Bass's ship showed his position to the enemy, who opened a vigorous cannonade and prepared themselves to meet the attack. But nothing daunted by being discovered, he bore down on the Phoenix and became grappled with her. He then applied the match to the combustibles, but in such a way that his retreat to the boat was cut off, and he was obliged to leap overboard to escape the flames. 5 of his men were compelled to follow his example, and not being able to reach the boat, all perished in the water. Notwithstanding the Phoenix was on fire in several places, she was saved from destruction by cutting away portions of her rigging and slipping her cables. In the attack, the enemy lost nearly 70 men, besides some women and children who were on board the Ketch. I found this account particularly interesting in light of the story I told about another ship named the Polly in the 7th episode of American History for the Modern Patriot. Let's return to learning about barriers. That would be another chevaux de frise which was constructed between Plum Point and Polopel Island. After the chain near Fort Montgomery had snapped in November of 1776, General James Clinton suggested that a chevaux de frise be built approximately 10 miles upriver from Fort Montgomery. General Clinton reported to the New York Convention on March 12, 1777, that, quote, "The obstruction of the navigation is in great forwardness. A number of frames and blocks are ready for sinking." Although he estimated that the work would be completed by mid-April, notes from the convention on April 26th indicated that 2,000 pounds were authorized for continued work on the project. Evidently, cost overruns on defense projects are not a new thing. This project seems to have been a much more effective obstruction than the one constructed by Captain Cook. It was first order of business for British Commodore Hotham to order Sir James Wallace to proceed up the river and locate a passageway through the barrier as soon as the capture of Forts Clinton and Montgomery were completed in 1777. Less than 6 days after that order was issued, British Major General Vaughan and his accompanying troops were noted to have progressed up the river on October 14th. In the next episode of American History for the Modern Patriot, we will learn about perhaps the greatest obstruction built by the Continental Forces and the Patriot turned traitor who sought its destruction. Until next time, this is Dr. Susan Rempel encouraging you to remain motivated, informed, and engaged in the political process. Visit my website, www.bingoforpatriots.com, with more than 500 pages of documents, products, and information designed to motivate the modern patriot.